Every business has an ambition. PayPal Open is the platform designed to help you grow into yours. With business loans so you can expand and access to hundreds of millions of PayPal customers worldwide. And your customers can pay all the ways they want. With PayPal, Venmo, Pay Later, and all major cards. So you can focus on scaling up. When it's time to get growing, there's one platform for all business. PayPal Open. Grow today at paypalopen.com. Loans subject to approval in available locations.
Setlist, the music business podcast from CMU. This week, five music industry controversies to expect in 2022. Welcome to Setlist, the music business podcast from CMU. I'm Andy Malt. With me is Chris Cook. Hello, Chris.
Hello there. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year indeed. Did you have a nice break?
I had a pretty damn normal Christmas, apart from having to shove lateral flow test things up my nose several times.
Yeah, there was a lot of that.
Everything else was pretty much as normal, and I know I'm very lucky for that. So yes, I think the answer to your question is I had a good Christmas.
I'm hoping that putting swabs up your nose for Christmas will become a new tradition. In 100 years' time, people won't be able to remember why they do it, but they'll still do it.
Everyone will gather around the Christmas tree on Christmas Eve and stick a swab up their nose.
Yeah.
And wave it in the air. Do you think that's going to become part of the Christmas story?
I think it will become part of the nativity, yes.
It will probably
the
be
the main part.
They'll rewrite it so that the wise men, in order to get into Bethlehem, had to stick some things up their noses, and that will become part of the narrative. And yes. Well, who knows? Maybe you'll be right. Maybe we can do our bit by ensuring that it happens next Christmas, even if we can't have any influence on what's happening in 100 years' time.
Yeah, well, it's something to aim for, isn't it? Start small.
It is something to aim for. And maybe in 100 years' time, another tradition that won't be shiftable will be that there has to be a sausage roll-themed song Christmas number one in the UK, because it's kind of feeling like that is going to be for the next 100 years. I mean, it's kind of feeling like it's been like that for 100 years. But anyway, we're not here.
Surely they can't do that again.
Well, no, I mean, now they've got four, you kind of got to go for five, haven't you?
I know, but once you've got Ed Sheeran and Elton John, where do you go? They can't just do the big, you know, Christmas song of every year. You know, what if it's an old song of somebody who's died?
Elton's big mates of Little Nas X now, isn't he? So if you want to go for global dominant, is Little Nas X truly global yet? But certainly if you want to go big in the US, that is your sausage roll tie-up for 2022.
Okay, well, that sounds like you're making a prediction about who's going to be big in 2022.
I'm willing to make the prediction that there will be another Lad Baby sausage roll song at Christmas number one this year. That is the one prediction I'm quite happy to go on the record making.
Wow. Controversial, possibly. I don't know. I'm trying to segue into what we're talking about this week.
Yeah, do
you
that.
You keep controversially knocking me off course, because this week we are going to look at the five companies in the music industry who we think will be involved in big controversies in 2022, the things that we're going to be reporting on and talking about all through this year.
Yeah, because if you are a regular long-time listener to Setlist or a regular long-time reader of the CMU Daily, you will know that we live for the controversies in the music industry. It's the only reason we're here. We love it when controversial things happen, people fall out, people get angry. We like it most when it ends up in really messy litigation in the courts as well, because, you know, someone's got to keep the lawyers in. I mean, who thinks about the lawyers? No one ever thinks about the poor lawyers. We've got to keep them in work.
We do.
So yes, we like controversies here, and so we thought that we would make that the topic for this start of the year, almost special edition of Setlist.
Yeah, so we've looked into our music industry crystal ball to look ahead at what's coming over the next 12 months, and we've narrowed everything down to five companies who we think are going to be at the centre of people's anger. Some of them will be more used to that than others, and some of them will be more willing to fight back than others. But all of them will not be able to escape the fact that a lot of people are going to be angry about them.
So you've got the five on a list in front of you. We should go through them each in turn.
Yes, let's. So, number one, this is no surprise to anyone, Spotify. Spotify in 2022, we think, will continue to be the biggest streaming service on the planet. Don't think that's going to change in 2022.
Premium streaming service, we should add.
Premium streaming service, okay, if you want to be specific.
I.e. the ones that actually make decent money for the music industry.
Yes. Spotify will continue to be the biggest premium streaming service on the planet, and as a result of that, it will continue to take the majority of the heat for the streaming music industry.
Yeah, that's the pro and the con, I guess, of being the market leader. Because I did this myself. When I give my lectures and seminars and webinars about streaming, I find it really hard to not say Spotify when I mean streaming service. Because most of the time, what I'm explaining is how streaming works and how streaming services do deals with music companies and how those deals are structured and how the money flows through. And everything is, well, this is how streaming works. This is how streaming deals work. This is how streaming companies operate. And yet I nearly always, without even thinking, say, this is what Spotify's deals are like. This is how Spotify works. And I remember, like, that happened quite early in the growth of streaming when I was first talking about the streaming business. Back in the days when basically the number two streaming service was Deezer.
Oh, yeah.
do you remember that? And there was that brief period where Spotify and Deezer, in terms of user numbers, were pretty close to each other. Deezer was very big in France, Spotify in sort of, you know, Scandinavia and building in the UK. And then it just Spotify exploded and became so much bigger. And I remember thinking there was a period where Deezer must have been a bit annoyed that people started saying Spotify when they meant streaming services. And obviously there are pros to being the brand that everyone always talks about. Except when people are pissed off with streaming or people are being critical of streaming, because it means that when people are being pissed off about the streaming business model or aspects of the streaming business model, they are prone to say, I am pissed off with Spotify. Spotify doesn't work. I don't like Spotify. Sometimes they are specifically talking about something that Spotify has done, but quite often what they're really talking about is streaming, and they use Spotify as code for streaming.
Yeah, and for whatever criticisms there are of Spotify or streaming, I mean, it's not new for the big gatekeeper in music to be the big controversial figure in music, regardless of who that is.
Yeah, I mean, that's always kind of been the case within the artist community and parts of the music community at large. I mean, if you go back to the 90s, when the main way you made money was selling CDs, and the big media, radio stations, TV stations were the way that you got your music out to people. So I guess in the 90s, there was a period when HMV was really important for getting your music to market, and MTV and Radio 1 were really important for getting people to be aware of your music. And everyone hated HMV and MTV and Radio 1. I mean, they also loved them. They also schmoozed them. They also tried to get favors from all of them. But when things weren't working out, they would say, oh, I hate HMV, because if only HMV would stock my music, I would be a success. And if only Radio 1 would play my music, if only MTV would play my videos, everything would be fine. Bloody gatekeepers stopping me. And in a way, you could say Spotify has replaced all three of those.
Yeah.
HMV and Radio 1 and MTV. So the big gatekeeper. I mean, we're not saying that all the criticism of Spotify is not just. Some of it is legitimate criticism. But
oh, yeah.
Quite often, people are criticizing them partly because they are code for streaming in general, and partly because they're a big gatekeeper, and big gatekeepers in music usually get a lot of criticism from the wider music community.
So in terms of what form these controversies will take, I mean, there are a couple of big things coming up that we'll get onto, but there's also just the ongoing criticism of Spotify and streaming that goes on social media that we've discussed before that isn't always... Well, I don't know if I would say, yeah, not always helpful. And particularly, I mean, over Christmas, T-Pain posted the streaming rate card, which we've discussed many times before. The basically this card that shows how, well, depending on which version of the image it is, it says different things. It'll either tell you how many streams you have to get in order to earn minimum wage on each streaming service, or how many streams you have to get to earn a cent or a penny. This one was how many streams you have to get to earn $1. And so it broke all of those down, with YouTube Music being the worst, 1,250 streams to get $1 on YouTube Music. Second is Pandora, 752 streams. Third, then, is Spotify, 315 streams to earn $1. It goes down the list. Amazon Music is the next one, 249. Deezer, 156. Apple Music, 128. Tidal, 78, doing pretty well. And the best one, the streaming service that T-Pain reckons you should go for, is Napster, where you only have to stream a track 53 times before the artist earns $1. Fact there. All facts. Indisputable facts.
Now, as you've already alluded to, these rate cards, they do the rounds on social media every month or so, usually posted by an artist or someone in the artist community. And as we've discussed before on Setlist, there are no per stream rates in streaming. That's not how it works. It's not that the service pays a certain amount of money every time a track streams. It is true that at the end of any month, you can divide how many times your music was streamed by how much money anyone's service paid you, and then work out an average per play payout for that month. But it's not that they start with a rate card. And these rate cards that you see, they are always wild approximations based on relatively small data sets. And one of the reasons why Apple always looks like it pays a lot more money than Spotify, well, there's two reasons. The first reason is Spotify has a free service and a paid-for service. Apple does not. And what you earn on paid-for streaming is always way more than what you earn on free streaming. So if you take Spotify's free service and paid-for service and then average it out, it's going to make it look like across the board, you make a lot less on Spotify than Apple. Whereas a Spotify premium stream is going to be much closer to an Apple Music premium stream when you take free out of the equation. There's other reasons why Spotify tends to come out lower than Apple. Spotify has sold more family plans. It's bigger in emerging markets. Generally speaking, Spotify users play more music than Apple Music users. It may well be that Apple is actually, in terms of revenue share commitments, committing slightly more to the music industry than Spotify for various reasons. But things are much, much, much closer than these rate cards suggest. And when you get the really small services coming out high, there are various reasons for that, but it's very misleading. The idea that Napster is paying so much more per stream than anyone else, it's simply not true. And the key thing is, although YouTube does usually get some of the heat when these rate cards do the rounds on social media, because as you said, if you take the entire YouTube platform and you average it out, it looks like they're paying by far the least amount of money per stream. Often it is Spotify that gets a lot of the negative comments on social media. I think because the majority of the people seeing these rate cards on social media inevitably are probably Spotify subscribers. And so they all start saying, oh, maybe I should stop being a Spotify subscriber and I should go to Apple or I should go to Napster if it's more artist friendly. And so then when these rate cards do the rounds, which I say at the moment is about once a month, Spotify has a little mini controversy to deal with.
Yeah. And I mean, as you say, like, yeah, to suggest that Napster is somehow, you know, it's the plucky young streaming service looking out for artists and making sure they get paid much better. I mean, that's just not the case. I mean, part of the problem is Napster doesn't have very many users. And also, Napster sold a lot of bundles. Napster's got a lot of users who they're having their account paid for by maybe their mobile phone company. They don't even know they've got Napster, but that money's still going in due to that deal with their mobile phone provider. But they're not paying any music. So that kind of affects the rates. But, I mean, Napster did try to get some mileage off this on Twitter because lots of people, you know, T-Pain's got a lot of followers. Lots of people replying saying, wow, Napster, who would have thought Napster would be the one that's really kind of serving artists in the streaming world?
I mean, if we're being honest, what a lot of people were saying was, wow, does Napster still exist?
Well, that too. But Napster, the things Napster were retweeting were all these bits of praise where, I mean, all right, the person who does social media for Napster maybe doesn't know the inner workings of how the streaming economy works, but people at Napster know that they're not out there looking out for the artists and making sure they get paid more. So for them to present that as the truth on Twitter is, you know, disingenuous.
But handy for Napster, which is in the process of relaunching itself, having basically come into new ownership relatively recently. But yeah, that was the latest of the many controversies on social media that Spotify was involved in as a result of another misleading rate card doing the rounds.
But we're not here to talk about mini controversies. We're here to talk about big controversies, the big controversies that are going to take us through 2022 and kick the doors off. And one of those for Spotify and streaming more widely, but I mean, Spotify again is bears most of the focus for this, is the Copyright Royalty Board review in the US of streaming rates. Well, on two counts.
Yeah, so in the US, copyright law actually provides a compulsory license for the so-called mechanical copying of songs. No time really to go into explaining what that means, except that what it does mean is that the rate that streaming services pay to songwriters and music publishers is basically set in law. So whereas in most other countries, music publishers and collecting societies negotiate deals with the streaming services, those deals are often confidential. In the US, there's a body called the Copyright Royalty Board. It's basically three judges who hear arguments from every side, and then they basically set a rate card. Not everybody uses it, but a lot of services do. So it means that the debates over what streaming service should be paying a songwriter and a music publisher in the US all happens in the public domain before this panel of judges. And you said there were sort of two sides to this, because what the rate should be for the next 5-year period is being reviewed and debated and argued, but what should be paid for the last 5-year period is still being disputed concurrently. So there are basically two disputes. It's not just Spotify who are disputing the rate that the judges proposed should be put in place. Other streaming services are too, although notably not Apple. But as you say, it's generally Spotify that feels the most heat. And in the US this year, songwriters and music publishers, sometimes separately, sometimes together, they are going to be criticizing Spotify a lot. And it basically means that whenever Spotify tries to placate songwriters, which they do in a number of different ways, you will then get tweets and statements from the National Music Publishers Association and from various songwriter groups saying, yeah, Spotify, if you really cared about songwriters, you wouldn't be fighting the rate increases in the Copyright Royalty Board proceedings.
Yes. And so, as we say, the two counts of this, because yeah, the last time the rate was set was 2018, and it was decided that the rate would rise from 10.5% up to 15% up to this year, 2022. And as you say, there was the appeal over that, and that sparked a lot of controversy that has obviously gone on since 2018. But now it's gone on so long without any resolution that we've got to the point where the CRB has to decide the next rate for 2023 to 2027. And that is sparking new controversy, because all the interested parties have to submit what they think the rate should be. The songwriters went for 20%. The streaming services went for 10.5%. So that being what the rate was in 2017. So basically saying, we want the appeal to decide that the rate should never have been put up, and we want the CRB to decide that it should again not be put up, which again is not in line with most of the rest of the world, but most of the rest of the world doesn't have this court-ruled royalty rate. And I mean, it just means that from the streaming services perspective, it would be very hard for them now to say, oh, we don't think it should have been put up in 2018, but now, 2022, we think it will be fine being 15%, because they're already arguing that they don't think it should be 15%. So they're going to have to go for a low number. I assume that in the end, everyone's thinking, well, if one side goes for 10.5%, the other side goes for 20, it's going to meet somewhere in the middle. It'll be 15%. But the streaming services don't feel they can argue for 15%. And the songwriters are going to ask for more. I know they have to ask for a high figure, because if they don't ask for a high figure, they'll get somewhere lower than they want.
Yeah, maybe, but there will be a lot of arguing to get there. And generally speaking, the songwriters and the publishers win the PR war when that debate is ongoing. And because it's the biggest, Spotify feels the most heat. The other thing that could put Spotify back into a bit of controversy this year is the Discovery Mode service that it has been piloting for a while now, which allows labels and artists to influence the Spotify algorithm in return for accepting a discount on any royalties that are generated by streams based on the informed algorithm. And although everyone in the music industry agrees that you should be able, as an artist or label, to influence the streaming services algorithm, given how important those algorithms have become, A lot of people don't think you should have to pay for that. And there are actually quite a lot of people in the independent label community and the management community who are usually big Spotify supporters who really don't like Discovery Mode. So assuming at some point Spotify really starts to roll out Discovery Mode and tries to get more people involved, then that controversy might gain more momentum once again. So a number of ways in which we expect Spotify to be courting a little bit of controversy in 2022.
Now, number two on our list is Universal, obviously the biggest major label in the world, which late last year, floated on the stock exchange, which means we'll now get quarterly financial reports from the company. And those, like all public companies, quarterly financial reports, will be presenting their figures and talking about the company in a way that is designed to enthuse shareholders, that's potential shareholders and existing shareholders in the company. And it will be very difficult for a record company to enthuse its shareholders on one side and placate artists and songwriters on the other. That seems unlikely to happen.
Yeah, so this basically brings us back to the old economics of streaming debate that we've talked about endlessly on Setlist. Obviously, the way streaming works, and particularly how streaming money gets shared out, what we call the digital pie debate, has become a much, much bigger talking point over the last 18 months, with lots of people in the artist and songwriter community arguing that of the money that comes in from Spotify, etc., every month, far too much of it, they would argue, goes to record companies and particularly major record companies. Now, of course, of the money that is allocated to sound recordings by services like Spotify, how much of that reaches an artist depends entirely on the deal that they have done with the label or distributor they work with. They could be getting all of that money, they could be getting a few percent of the money, depending on what deal they did, when they did the deal, etc., etc. But we noted before that when the online conversation about the economics of streaming that led to the parliamentary inquiry here in the UK on the streaming business, when the online conversation first began early in the COVID pandemic, when lots of artists suddenly started focusing more on the streaming revenue stream as other revenue streams started to fall away, initially, as is often the case, Spotify got a lot of the criticism. And lots of artists and songwriters were saying, streaming doesn't work, we don't make any money out of streaming, it's all Spotify's fault, for the reasons we've just discussed. But by the time the debate got to Parliament and became political here in the UK, the debate has moved on. And actually, what an increasing number of artists and songwriters and organisations representing artists and songwriters were saying was, we might have some issues with the Spotify model and the streaming model, but actually, our biggest issue is, of the money that comes in for recordings, how much is shared with the artist or not, as the case may be. So by the time the debate arrived in the Houses of Parliament, really it was the record labels and particularly the major labels that felt the most heat. And Universal is the biggest. So just like Spotify will probably get most of the heat when people are being critical of streaming, I think we're going to find that Universal will get the most heat whenever people put their attention back on how streaming money is shared out. And there are various reasons for that other than Universal being the biggest. The thing you said at the start of this section, very important. The fact that Universal is now directly listed on the Dutch Stock Exchange. So it was previously owned by a publicly listed company, Vivendi in France, and Vivendi would put quarterly reports out to their shareholders, which would include a section on Universal Music. But once a music company is directly listed on a stock exchange, it's so much easier to scrutinise what's going on and how much money is being made. Now, Universal's main rival is Sony Music, Warner as well, but in terms of size, Warner's quite a lot smaller than the other two. Warner is also directly listed on a stock exchange, but Sony is part of SonyCore. So again, Sony's stats are deep inside SonyCore's stats. So I think what we're going to see is once a quarter throughout 2022, Universal is going to put out its report to its shareholders. It's going to report that music rights continue to be making lots of money. There's lots of growth in recordings. Streaming is still booming. Plus, of course, on the publishing side, slowly things will start to recover post-COVID. And so Universal will be saying, look how well we're doing. Music rights are booming. We're the biggest player in music rights. You should all be wanting to invest in us. Meanwhile, every time that happens, you're going to have lots of artists and songwriters coming forward and saying, well, it's great that you're doing so well out of streaming. We're not seeing the benefit of that. And the reason for that is unfair record deals, etc., etc., etc. So I think Universal will find itself with at least four controversies this year around the digital pie and economics of streaming debate each time they put out their quarterly report.
Yeah, and in fact, we've already seen the kind of foreshadowing of this, because last year when the company floated, its CEO Lucian Grainge got a big pay packet. His total pay for the year was over £150 million, thanks to a bonus of £123 million at the point which the company floated on the stock exchange. And people didn't take kindly to that. In fact, it was very quickly framed as Lucian Grainge, CEO of Universal, earns more than all of the UK's composers and songwriters combined. And that is quite a controversial statement. It doesn't present him in a very good light. And I think, I mean, possibly won't get a headline like that one because that was this big one-off payment, but we are going to see big, bold statements like that as soon as Universal's figures come out every 3 months. And that's certainly going to go on through 2022, probably longer. But I think at the moment, there's a lot of things aligning that make those figures more controversial than they might be at other times in the future.
Yeah, and the critics of the majors in the artist and songwriter community, I'm sure, will find similarly bold sounding stats. I mean, the stat, as you've just explained it, I mean, there are some footnotes that you need to read.
Oh, yes. Well, I said that it was framed that way. I didn't say that was exactly right.
We'll include a link to our report on it, which actually explains what they were saying. But the point is, it was a great stat to be sharing on social media, and I'm sure similar bold stats will be found. Plus, I mean, again, to distinguish Universal from Sony, I think Sony will feel a little bit of heat around these debates as well. But not only does Sony not have a financial report specifically for Sony Music every quarter, it is included in Sony Calls report, so there is some reporting, but not to the same extent as we will get for Universal Music. Plus, the big difference between Sony and Universal is that Sony has started to make some gestures towards critics in the artist community. The big one, of course, being paying through streaming royalties on pre-2000 record contracts where the artist hasn't recouped on the original advance, etc., that they got from the label back pre-2000. And although that, you know, item one on quite a big wish list from the artist and songwriter and management community, it is quite a big gesture. And Universal Music hasn't really even spoken about any of this, or not in a huge way, even sought to engage the artist and songwriter community. So I think that although a lot of the ways in which Universal are going to be criticised, you could make some or all of those criticisms, certainly of the other majors, and in some cases of record companies in general, Universal Music is going to get the most heat because it's the biggest, it's directly listed on the stock exchange. And if we're being honest, in terms of having some gestures towards placating the artist community, it has not moved as much as Sony to date. Maybe it will at some point in 2022, although my gut instinct is that it probably won't. So, yeah, we're expecting lots of Universal Music mini controversies throughout the year.
Now, on to number three, and a name that long-time Setlist listeners will have been used to hearing quite frequently in the past, but we've not really heard that much from for the last couple of years, because there's been this global pandemic thing, and Viagogo is very much in the live music business, which has very much not really been a thing for the last 2 years. But in 2022, it looks like live music is going to come back with a vengeance, and there'll be unprecedented demand for tickets, and that creates a big opportunity for touts. And as more people want to get out and go back to live shows, it's going to really annoy them when they can't get those tickets that they want at face value from the primary sellers because they're all on Viagogo for £1,000 each.
Yeah, so we've discussed at length on past editions of Setlist, and we've written about it an awful lot in the CME Daily, the ongoing controversies around online ticket touting, the resale of tickets by unofficial sellers at a markup through platforms like Viagogo. And obviously back in the day, there were four big secondary ticketing platforms operating in the UK, two actually owned by Live Nation and Ticketmaster, and then there was Viagogo and StubHub. Then Ticketmaster shut down its secondary ticketing sites in much of the world because of the controversy, because ticket touting was so unpopular in big parts of the artist community and management community. And of course, this is the one controversy within the music industry where fans really care. I mean, I'm sure some fans wish artists got more money from Spotify. Maybe lots of fans do. But ticket touting and secondary ticketing is where actually fans really feel the cost, the financial burden of the fact that tickets get bought up and resold online at a markup. So we had lots of controversies. At one point, it actually looked like there was only going to be pretty much one ticket resale platform in the UK, because of course Viagogo bought its main rival StubHub. Actually, and this is the one Viagogo story that has been running throughout the pandemic, because of regulator demands here in the UK, ultimately outside of North America, it sold off StubHub. So there are technically still two big resale platforms here in the UK. But I think, yeah, you're right, as live starts to come back, as the big shows, the big international tours slowly start to come back, we would expect for those big artists who have not been properly touring for 2 years now, that there will be unprecedented demand for their shows. Unprecedented demand creates big opportunities for the touts and the platforms that they use. So we would anticipate a whole load more ticket touting controversies where fans are outraged on social because they can't get tickets to shows, or they're having to pay massive markups to get tickets to shows. Certain artists, I mean, obviously Ed Sheeran has been one of the most vocal artists on this over the years. So certain artists will take to social media to slag this off as well. And I think Viagogo will feel the heat for various reasons. It's kind of the biggest now on a global basis. And of course, even back in the day when there were the four secondary ticketing platforms, it was generally Viagogo who got the most criticism, and that's kind of Viagogo's fault.
Well, I mean, I said at the beginning, some of these companies will be more willing than others to fight back, and it's Viagogo that will be the most willing to fight back. Because although, I mean, it went through many years where it just said nothing at all, and that helped to make it more controversial. So it decided to start putting out statements, start talking back, start addressing its critics. But it's always been very bold in its defense of its business, and also very self-assured that it's in the right and that its critics are all wrong, and it's perfectly fine for Viagogo to be doing what it's doing. And in fact, it now is more positioning itself as a champion of a competitive ticketing marketplace.
Yeah, I'd say if anything, the statements they've been putting out over the last couple of years have been getting bolder and bolder. So after that period where they just said nothing, then their statements were kind of like, oh, all of this criticism is invalid. Obviously, secondary ticketing is regulated in many countries, and here in the UK, the regulations have been beefed up and more properly enforced in recent years. But usually when Viagogo is accused of breaking the rules, they'll be like, no, we're not breaking the rules. I mean, quite often the Competition and Markets Authority, and indeed at certain points in recent years, the courts and Parliament have been quite clear that they have been breaking rules at various points. But usually they're like, no, we're not breaking the rules. And when there have been times when there have been specific issues with Viagogo's platform that they can't deny, then they've had this tendency to say, oh, there was a little bit of a problem, but we're learning. We're a learning, developing company, and we're working with our customers and with the regulators to get this right. Even though it's like, well, you have been doing that for 10 years now. Maybe you should have learned whatever it was you were going to learn some time ago. But yeah, coming back to your point, actually now it feels like they are wanting to talk more about the fact that in a lot of countries, particularly the US, but here in the UK and some other European markets as well, often artists and promoters will put the majority of their tickets with one primary ticketing agent. And as they're putting more measures in place to stop the resale of those tickets and to make it more difficult, whether that's legally or technically, for people to tout tickets, think Viagogo are increasingly going to say, oh, that's monopolistic. The big companies of the live industry are trying to be in control, and fans should have the right to resell tickets and to get tickets from different places. And I think that is going to be Viagogo's strategy in the next year. And I suppose in addition to the fact that live hopefully is going to properly return at some point in the next 12 months, which will mean touting becomes a much bigger issue again, I mentioned those regulations. Although here in the UK, the regulations have increased in recent years and are being better enforced, although there are still plenty of issues, that's not true all around the world, but we're starting to see more of a clampdown elsewhere in Europe. So I think some of the regulatory stuff we've seen here in the UK in recent years, we're going to start seeing in other countries in Europe. We're already seeing that in some of the European markets. And that will these will just create ever more reasons why Viagogo is going to be involved in some controversies.
So we're on to number four, and number four, not a music company, for, you know, a bit of variety. It is Twitter. Twitter, obviously, social network, you've probably heard of it. It's probably the one major platform out there that really doesn't seem to have made any moves whatsoever to doing licensing deals with music companies, despite many years now of music companies saying that it really should.
Yeah, so whereas there was that point a few years back, particularly when copyright law was being reconsidered across Europe with the Copyright Directive, where it always felt like YouTube was the big digital platform that the music industry loved to hate. Loved to love as well, in terms of putting lots of content on YouTube and using it as a marketing platform, etc. But obviously, YouTube came in for a lot of heat, not the YouTube music service, obviously, but the main YouTube platform as a user upload platform, a platform that's kind of in sort of the video sharing social media space. It was always YouTube that people used to say, okay, they're exploiting loopholes in copyright law. They're exploiting the safe harbor. So much music is consumed on YouTube. We make lot less money on YouTube than on Spotify, etc. This is a problem. And then, of course, the Copyright Directive was passed in the EU, not the UK, obviously, because of Brexit. But copyright law has been rewritten across much of Europe now, basically increasing the liabilities of platforms like YouTube. But interestingly, even by the time the directive finally was passed in Europe, you felt that quite a lot of the music industry had already made good with YouTube. Mm. By that point, the actual YouTube streaming service had been launched, but YouTube, which let's not forget, I mean, again, when we're defending these companies, we are also acknowledging that there have been some issues over the years, and there continue to be some issues. But then YouTube has had licenses from the music industry since the late 2000s. So, mm. It has been a partner of the music industry for a long time. And there are now lots of other ways that you can make money on YouTube as an artist and as a music company. YouTube is selling so much more advertising on its main platform now. And ultimately, YouTube's deals with the music industry are sharing that advertising revenue. So people in the music industry don't publicly diss YouTube anywhere like they used to. And actually, almost as soon as the Copyright Directive had gone through and as the safe harbor across Europe was being reformed, it did feel like, particularly with the majors, but actually with other people in the record industry as well, that a couple of other platforms were rising up the list of the safe harbor dwelling platforms that we don't like and we like to diss. And the platforms that we always reference when we're saying to ministers in the UK and the US, you need to reform your safe harbor too, just like the EU has. And as the copyright reforms in Europe have been put into European law within each of the member states of the EU, the platforms we reference when we're saying to lawmakers, you mustn't water down these reforms when you're putting them into national law because we have these issues. I would say that two big platforms have been mentioned a lot in the last couple of years in this whole debate, and that is Twitter, but also Twitch.
Yeah, over the last 2 or 3 years, Twitch has been the big company in the news about not having licensing deals. Big controversy. Obviously, that controversy is boosted by the fact that it's owned by Amazon, and Amazon is not short of money. So, you know, everyone's like, surely Amazon could afford to back a few licensing deals for Twitch and just sort this problem out. Twitch has been quite resistant, although it has done some deals with a few DIY distributors, but you know, no major all-encompassing deals. It did do a deal with Warner, but that's not a licensing deal at all. But the fact that it's working with Warner suggests that maybe there's some movement in the direction of getting things sorted out. But Twitch did do a lot of things to try to say it didn't need to get licensing deals, including, I mean, trying to get its users on side with it. And it set up that kind of music library of its own for its users to use instead of using music that was unlicensed. But ultimately, I mean, it seems inevitable that it will do deals eventually. And I think it's probably going to happen sometime this year, maybe later this year. But it seems likely it will happen, at which point all attention moves to Twitter, because at that point, Twitter is kind of the last one left.
Yeah, I do agree. It feels like, well, first of all, we know that Twitch is having active conversations with the music industry, even though it has occasionally put out, well, there was that blog post, wasn't there, last year, where it was saying, this was to its users, because it's had quite a lot of backlash from its users about all the takedowns, which is one of the reasons why Twitch really needs to sort this out, because it doesn't want to get backlash from the big gamers on the platform. But it did do that blog post where it's like, yeah, we should get licenses. I'm paraphrasing slightly. Yeah, we should get some licenses, but, you know, music licensing is really complicated, and there aren't really any licenses available for our kind of service. And it wasn't a very convincing, I mean, they're right, music licensing is crazy complicated. But the idea that they are that unique a platform, that there's no template that they could take to work with, that's not true. But yeah. I think the reason why I feel Twitch will slowly get things sorted, yeah, I mean, first of all, if they need to, they can get access to the money to pay the upfront fees and the advances and the stuff like that to the labels. Also, the backlash from their users, particularly in the gaming community, they can't really afford to have too much of a backlash. Plus, of course, and one of the reasons why the music industry started to get a little bit more aware of just how much music was being used in particularly the live streams, but also some of the archive on demand content on Twitch, was because Twitch had been trying to encourage musicians and DJs to use the platform. Mm. And during COVID and the lockdown, when live streaming was booming, an increasing number of artists and DJs were using the platform, and hence, you know, the Warner deal that you mentioned. So I think for a combination of it having the resources and the expertise within the group, and it not wanting to piss off all the gamers who use music in their streams, and the fact that it is actively courting artists and labels to get involved in Twitch as creators, it has to get these licenses sorted. And I think we will start to see some licensing deals done. Yes, there'll still be lots of gaps, particularly on the publishing side. But I think once it's got a big licensing deal in place with one of the majors, it's going to fall down the list of the platforms that get mentioned whenever the music industry is having a copyright moan in front of politicians and lawmakers.
Yes, and at that point, Twitter will be assured that position as number one enemy of the music industry, certainly in the digital licensing domain, because, I mean, Twitter, well, like Facebook used to, we'll argue, well, we're not a music platform. Music is not what we're here for. Why should we get licenses? But the fact remains that whether that's what it's there for or not, music is on that platform, and the music industry is not going to stop arguing that it should be paid for it to be there. And so, yeah, I mean, obviously, as you say, the focus is on Twitch at the moment, but the focus will move elsewhere, and it will move to Twitter. I think there's also, I mean, the things moving at a similar time, there's the possibility of getting artists involved in this argument too. And I think there's been, I mean, this is not something new, but I think there's more artists at the moment kind of complaining about the fact that in order to keep their career going, they're constantly having to make content for social media. And I mean, you know, more and more social media and more complicated content. And that's taking away from their time creating, you know, music, which is the content they want to be creating. And if artists get pissed off with that, they might be more willing to start saying, yeah, and where's my money, Twitter?
Yeah, so maybe pop stars as well as lobbyists from the record industry and the record companies will decide that the one digital platform it's cool to diss on copyright grounds in 2022 is Twitter. And we hope so, because that will be more controversy for us to write about.
Yeah, and now we're on to our final company, number five on our list. And one, I mean, this is a story we have already written a lot about, despite it only really being a few weeks old. But I mean, the company is Live Nation, and this all comes off the back of the Astroworld tragedy, which happened in November, when crowd surges resulted in the death of 10 people at the festival. Hundreds of lawsuits have followed with demands for billions of dollars in damages. Now, initially, a lot of the controversy focused on Travis Scott as the founder of the festival, but increasingly it's shifting over to Live Nation, the promoter of the event. And there are now lots of lawyers and politicians lining up to place the blame on Live Nation. And the debate is quickly moving on from failures at Astroworld to questions about the company's safety record more widely.
Yeah, so we had an edition of Setlist late last year where we talked through the Astroworld tragedy and the various investigations that had been launched, the questions that were being asked, and all of those hundreds and hundreds of lawsuits that have been filed. Since then, unsurprisingly, lawyers working for Travis Scott are trying to get him removed as a defendant on those lawsuits. Obviously, that in itself has proven to be and will continue to prove to be a little bit controversial. Although the arguments in favour of removing Travis Scott from the lawsuits, I mean, they're pretty sound arguments, which is, well, the headline artist on stage is not responsible for what happens on the ground in the crowd. That's for the promoters and the organisers of the event, and that being Live Nation and one of their subsidiaries called Scoremore. So I think you're right. As these lawsuits progress, more and more focus is going to come on Live Nation, specifically in relation to Astroworld. Obviously, it's quite hard to comment on the specifics of what happened at that festival until the criminal investigation reports, until these things get into court, because there's so many unanswered questions and an awful lot of online speculation about exactly what happened before and during the event. But it is interesting, both in the litigation, but also politically, that some people are trying to make this a bigger conversation about safety at events, and in some cases, specifically about how Live Nation goes around planning and producing its festivals and the other major events that it's involved in.
Yeah, and in terms of the political side of this, just before Christmas, the Committee on Oversight and Reform in US Congress wrote to Live Nation boss Michael Rapino demanding information relating to the Astroworld tragedy, including any contracts the company has regarding security, communications and medical care at the Astroworld festival. But that letter that it sent also raises questions more widely, as I said. So it says, the tragedy at Astroworld Festival follows a long line of other tragic events and safety violations involving Live Nation. For example, Live Nation has been fined or sued numerous times over safety issues at previous events, including other incidents involving surging fans or stampedes. From 2016 to 2019, Live Nation and its subsidiary Live Nation Worldwide were cited 10 times for safety violations and incurred fines.
Now, to what extent the criticisms that were either explicitly contained in that letter or alluded to in that letter, to what extent those criticisms of Live Nation in general are fair, is very much of debate. And obviously, when you have a company as big as Live Nation involved in as many events in the US and worldwide as Live Nation, I mean, with all the best will in the world, even where you have promoters and festivals and events that have absolute best practice when it comes to things like safety and security and crowd control, and Live Nation, you know, have plenty of events which would definitely fall into that category, there will always be some issues at some events, and all the best will in the world, that's not completely avoidable. So I suppose, you know, when politicians and lawyers are citing stats in this regard, you have to put it into the context of the total number of events and, of course, what the specific allegations and fines and lawsuits relate to. So, you know, I think there's a lot of debate to be had, not only about the specifics of what happened at Astroworld last November, but also if we're going to put it out wider. I mean, obviously, if there are any learnings from that event, whether those are logistical, production-based, or they're corporate-based in terms of how big companies like Live Nation share knowledge and expertise across the business, how the industry can get better at sharing knowledge and expertise across the business. Because there are some people in the industry, I mean, here in the UK, there are certain people who are particularly good at things like crowd control, and it's great when that knowledge is then shared across the industry. But whatever direction all of that takes, There are some interesting conversations going on here, and I think the Astroworld litigation is going to be multi-layered. It's going to be extensive, layer on the political dimension, both within Houston and US-wide. This is going to be a big talking point throughout 2022, and it does feel like as the story develops, Travis Scott will be talked about less, Live Nation will be talked about more. And so, I mean, in some ways, a lot more serious than a lot of the other stuff we've talked about on this edition of Setlist. But I think we are going to be writing about this story a lot, and it will be interesting to see how Live Nation comes out of all of that conversation and how they respond, both legally, but also in sort of PR terms and media terms, to all of the things that are going to be discussed in the courts and within the political community in the US in the next 12 months.
So you can expect lots of serious and, I suppose, some flippant reporting on the big controversies in 2022, depending obviously on the controversy, in the CMU Daily and here on Setlist. But that's all we've got time for on this forward-looking edition of Setlist. We will be back next week with our usual back-looking edition. It will be looking back at the previous 7 days in the music industry rather than the coming 12 months. So do, if you haven't already, subscribe on your podcast app of choice in order to receive new episodes automatically. If you've enjoyed this, rate and review it somewhere, anywhere you like, but I mean, probably in a podcast app, and that would be helpful to us. If you want to discuss anything that we've spoken about on this edition of the show, then email us setlist@unlimitedmedia.co.uk. Setlist is the music business podcast from CMU. It's presented by Andy Malt and Chris Cook. And for more on CMU, go to completemusicupdate.com.
Every business has an ambition. PayPal Open is the platform designed to help you grow into yours. With business loans so you can expand and access to hundreds of millions of PayPal customers worldwide. And your customers can pay all the ways they want. With PayPal, Venmo, Pay Later, and all major cards. So you can focus on scaling up. When it's time to get growing, there's one platform for all business. PayPal Open. Grow today at paypalopen.com. Loan subject to approval in available locations.